They come every season, and not just in summer. They usually, but not always, boast A-level casts, and they almost always are filled with things that go boom. Hi, I'm Dan Webster, host of Movies 101. And on this week's special edition, Mary Pat Truthart, Nathan Weinbinder, and I will discuss the blockbuster, what that term means, what its effects have been, and what we think have been some of the genre's best and worst examples. So don't touch that dial, because Movies 101 is coming up next, right here on Spokane Public Radio.
Gumbo is New Orleans tradition, a stew combining several varieties of meat, seafood, and vegetables in a thick sauce. The band Beausoleil avec Michael Doucet cooks up a fine musical gumbo, combining Zydeco, New Orleans jazz, Tex-Mex country, and blues. And two pair of tickets to Beausoleil's October 5th appearance at the Fox in Spokane are our August membership drawings, which also include $100 gift cards from Spencer's for steaks and chops at the Doubletree. How to enter? Go to SpokanePublicRadio.org for full particulars. Sustaining members, you are automatically in the drawings, and while pledging is not needed to enter the drawings, your support is key to keeping us a strong presence both on air and online.
Hi, I'm Dan Webster, film critic for Spokane Public Radio and blogger for Spokane7.com.
And I'm Mary Pat Truthart, part-time film critic, full-time law professor at Gonzaga Law School.
And I'm Nathan Weinbinder, also a film critic for Spokane Public Radio and film and music editor for The Inlander.
And welcome to a special edition of Movies 101, one that is dedicated to that special brand of film called the blockbuster. If you consult the dictionary, this is what you're likely to find. Blockbuster, noun, informal, a thing of great power or size, in particular a movie, book, or other product that is a great commercial success. The actual genesis of the word blockbuster comes out of World War II and involves the kinds of bombs that would actually take out entire blocks at a time. It's fitting, then, that the word is applied to films in which things do blow up, mostly. Let me begin by sharing some quotes about blockbusters. Action star Jason Statham of The Transporter and other movies. Without doing the big blockbusters, I wouldn't be able to find the money to go after little projects that I want to do. This is what the late critic Roger Ebert had to say. Blockbusters run the mainstream industry. We may never again have a decade like the 1970s when directors were able to find such freedom. And let's talk about Connie Nielsen, who has just starred in the recent Wonder Woman. She said, "Often when you get a really good script and you receive the new pages, you see that the entire thing has been dumbed down. Films in the 30s and 40s that were huge blockbusters were very sophisticated in their language and the ideas they brought. There were no questions about whether the audience would get it or not." So that brings up a good question. She's talking about blockbusters in the 30s and 40s. What comes up for you guys when we talk about blockbuster?
Well, the term blockbuster, I mean, as you said, it refers to anything of general great success. But I think the word has become synonymous with films like what's coming out of Marvel Studios right now. Superhero movies, essentially. I mean, that's where all the money is these days. I mean, that's what everybody is going to see. And so naturally, when someone says blockbuster, I think of something with Stallone or Schwarzenegger or something with lots of special effects and explosions. Usually genre films. I mean, it's very rare that a character-based drama or a comedy becomes a blockbuster, but it is possible. Anchorman, you could argue, was a blockbuster, my beloved Anchorman.
The
original Ghostbusters, absolutely. Pretty much anything with Bill Murray from the late 70s, early 80s, I mean, he was huge. But then you also have movies that were kind of the unexpected blockbuster, and a lot of these movies are low-budget fare. So something like, speaking of 70s and 80s comedies, Animal House, which nobody thought was going to be any good at all, and then it was one of the biggest-selling R-rated comedies comedies of all time. It happens a lot in horror because horror movies are so cheap to produce. So you look at something like Halloween or Paranormal Activity or just recently Get Out, which were made for really small budgets. In the case of Paranormal Activity, I think it costs like $10,000 or something like that. And they end up not only raking in money hand over fist, but inspiring franchises that just keep coming out.
Evil Dead.
Evil Dead movies were never blockbusters, but Sam Raimi did go on to use those formulas to much bigger financial success.
So I think when we talk about blockbusters, most of us would automatically go toward Jaws, for example. And so I think we need to come back to that because I think over time the notion of a blockbuster has shifted somewhat. Because I think if you look at blockbuster from a couple of different perspectives, first of all, did it have a big budget going in? And typically we associate blockbusters with that, but not always,
right,
as Nathan pointed out. Is it a high-grossing film? I think we associate blockbusters with that. Does it have a wide audience reach, not only
lots
in the
appeal,
U.S.,
yeah,
but across the globe now?
Yeah,
because I think
that's,
globe,
yeah,
you know, that's a factor that we have to consider too. But I still do, for the most part, equate blockbusters or the notion of a summer blockbuster with some sort of action or, mm-hmm, you know, a fast-paced type of thing. And so I think we can come back and look at that because I do think we have some good examples of that. And then, as Nathan pointed out, we have some things that defy categorization.
Right.
But now, in retrospect, we might apply the moniker blockbuster to them, even though it didn't seem that way at the time.
You know, going back to that dictionary definition, the final three words there were great commercial success. And I think we have to point out that just because a movie is a blockbuster and it has a $250 million budget doesn't mean it is going to meet that definition. Because if it only makes $250 million, it doesn't even cover its costs. So, mm-hmm, it's a blockbuster wannabe. But
sure,
can it really be a blockbuster, say the way Jaws ended up being, say, mm-hmm, the way the first real blockbuster after Jaws was Star Wars in 1977? That's the one that everybody said, oh my God, look, these sci-fi movies, these genre movies, these action genre movies, they're going to make a lot of people very rich.
And then you saw all of the ripoffs in the wake of those film's success. Lots of killer shark movie or killer fish movies.
Orca,
the Deep, Piranha, the Joe Dante film. And then,
yes,
you know, after Star Wars, we had even more of those. The notion of a blockbuster, this huge cultural object that becomes something that everybody goes to see, that everybody throws money at. I mean, it existed before Jaws, but it does seem interesting, to me at least, that Jaws kind of represents the starting point. Like, Jaws is generally considered the first summer blockbuster.
And that was 1975.
1975, but I mean, even if you go back, it wasn't in the summertime, but you go back a couple of years, one of the highest grossing films of 1973 was The Exorcist. I mean, that was a true blockbuster. People lined up down the street to see The Exorcist. It's usually not talked about in the same breath as Jaws, even though it was the same cultural phenomenon. And it's amazing to me, too, because can you imagine a movie like The Exorcist getting, first of all, made and bankrolled by a major studio today, but then getting that kind of response from just, you know, Joe Blow and middle America? I mean, that's the kind of thing that we don't see all that often, because The Exorcist is maybe a genre film, but it's an art film, too. And very rarely do art films make that kind of money.
It's not often that a guy with the talent of a William Friedkin, mm-hmm, takes on a genre film. And
true,
he did, and he did a great job.
Mm-hmm. Well, so you, in passing, raised another issue that a lot of people might associate blockbuster movies with these macho male characters.
Yeah.
And so I think that
the Stallones and the,
yeah, that, as you were pointing, yes, out, Nathan, at the beginning. And so I think that's an intriguing thing to explore a little bit, because this summer, I think we did have multiple films where there were women, you know, in the lead roles. And if we include the Valerian film.
We don't.
Okay, if we did, then that would be even more. But certainly Wonder Woman and Atomic Blonde are...
Mm-hmm. Well, Wonder Woman, I mean, the staying power of that movie has,
yeah,
been phenomenal.
Yeah.
When you talk about wannabe blockbusters, too, I mean, look at Valerian and the City of a Thousand Planets. You almost need,
right,
to take a breath in the middle of saying that title, which was, we reviewed it a couple of weeks ago, the new Luc Besson science fiction film. That supposedly had a budget of over $200 million, which even in the era of inflated budgets that we live in now, that's an exorbitant amount of money to spend And on a property like Valerian, which, you know, is something that outside of Europe, I don't think many people are familiar with. And you look at that movie and you go, okay, it cost this much money to make. It's made a fraction of its budget back. Does it still count as a blockbuster just because it's so big and weighty and has all of those expectations tied to it? So I think you could argue either way.
Mm-hmm. And I do believe that we could look at some comedic films. That's another subgenre of mm-hmm. this. But when I think back to a blockbuster that had a strong female character, obviously the Alien series comes up. And I do think that that's not our only criterion. But I do think that because Hollywood has this ongoing woman problem in terms of who's directing, I think there have been only 4 women nominated for Best Director awards, and
only one is one.
Yeah, and only one is one. Although mm-hmm. she has another film coming out this summer,
right.
Catherine Bigelow. Yeah,
probably
yeah.
not in the category of a blockbuster.
No. In fact, I think The Hurt Locker, her film that won Best Picture, is one of the, if not the lowest grossing Best Picture winners ever.
That brings up a whole nother conversation, and we'll get into that, comparing these blockbusters and where they are on the list of all-time moneymakers versus, say, the AFI or Metacritic's list of the best films that have ever been made. But I wanted to go back and revisit something you were talking about in terms of The Exorcist. The main thing that separated and distinguishes Jaws from The Exorcist came out in December.
Right.
Jaws came out in July. Jaws came out in a time.
That was a summer movie, for sure.
And I was living in San Diego at the time, and I remember it was a hot afternoon, and we said, no, let's not go to the beach. Let's go to a movie theater.
And then you never went back to the beach again after you saw Jaws.
Absolutely not, which was one of the big selling points
right.
of the original film. And it was the film, and famously so, I'm not revealing anything here, that convinced Hollywood that movies will play during the summer. Because at that time, up till that time, pretty much the common feeling was they're all going to the beach. Nobody's going to the movies.
Right.
So they'll dump all the crappy movies then and save all the good movies for before Christmas or whatever. But that changed everything.
And Jaws was also one of the first films to be released in over however many theaters. You know, there was initially a threshold where a movie would open in bigger cities and then slowly roll out, like we see a lot with the indie films that still come out and foreign films and that sort of thing. Jaws opened in hundreds of theaters all at once, which was an unusual business strategy. I mean, that was something that really hadn't been explored before. And after that, that just became the common practice. I mean, that's what everybody does now, and it's
which
because
makes
of that film.
Star Wars more surprising because Star Wars opened in very few theaters.
Yeah, correct.
And it was people lining up down the street
yeah.
wanting to see that movie that said, hey, maybe we should open this in some more. And it slowly grew and then became the...
And like Jaws, Star Wars was a movie that nobody thought was going to be as huge as it was. I mean, George Lucas famously ran away to, I think it was Hawaii with Steven Spielberg, actually, because he was so afraid of the box office receipts. And then he didn't know the movie was a hit until he saw a news report about it while he was on vacation. And of course, we all know the production problems that plagued Jaws. So sometimes these blockbusters, I mean, they kind of come out of nowhere.
Yeah. With that, I need to say that this is Movies 101, and it's time to take a short break. But before we go, remember that you can access podcasts of Movies 101 by going online at SpokanePublicRadio.org. While there, check out the individual reviews that Nathan and I write. Don't do it now, though, because we'll be right back to continue our discussion about blockbusters, good and bad. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio.
Thank you.
And we're back. This is Movies 101, and I'm your host, Dan Webster. During the first half of the show, Mary Pat Truthart, Nathan Weinbinder, and I discussed the notion of the blockbuster, those huge releases that have become the standard for mainstream movie entertainment. Let's continue. One of the things that I wanted to talk about was the difference between what critics consider the best films of all time and then those films that make the all-time box office list. Mm-hmm. I look at, say, the AFI's 100 Greatest American Films of All Time, and I've got to go down to number 13 before I find Star Wars and number 24 before I find E.T. the Extraterrestrial. All the rest of them are art films that are independent films that are films that have just huge acclaim. Yet I go over to boxofficemojo.com, which runs a list of the top grossing films of all time, and I can't even find any art films among the top 50. It begins with Avatar, Titanic, Star Wars, The Force Awakens, Jurassic World, Marvel's The Avengers. It's all blockbusters.
And they're all, and this is an important thing, is they're all properties based on things that people already know. And that's becoming more and more the case. You look, every year you look at the top 10 grossing films. After all is said and done, 1 through 10 is almost always populated with sequels, reboots, remakes, which suggests to me, and it's not exactly a revelation, that people want to know what they're going to get when they walk into the theater. It seems rare to me that people will walk into a movie and stumble in deliberately blind. I don't want to know what this is about. Mm-hmm. It seems to me that people aren't willing to put down their money for something that they're not already familiar with.
So you said the familiarity is what drives this in mm-hmm. part. I think that if you look at big stars, think back to the Mission Impossible type of films. If you look on some of these top grossing films, I mean, you can see franchises such as mm-hmm. that. When I was asking people, what do you think a blockbuster is? Most people were pegging it in the action category that mm-hmm. Nathan mentioned. But other things came up, such as Footloose or Grease or Mamma Mia
sure.
or My Big Fat Greek Wedding, the first one. Because I think people sometimes, if we're looking at summer blockbusters in particular, want to gravitate towards something that really is mindless and, you know, maybe keeps your attention, is fun. And so I think, Dan, if you go back to something such as Avatar, I mean, that really met a lot of people's expectations about what they wanted a film of that sort to be. How much do you think word of mouth has to do with this? So now we're building up through social media ahead of time mm-hmm. all of these opportunities. I think one of the things about Star Wars is it wasn't just the film itself. It was this whole product line mm-hmm. of things that it generated. And so I think that plays into not only the gross financial aspect of the film, but what kind of legs it has and what mm-hmm. sort of pervasiveness it has.
Well, we're also talking about what blockbusters have become. They've become now something that is based upon a franchise, based upon an idea, based upon people's expectations. And let's go back to what Con Nielsen was talking about, movies of the 30s and 40s. That was much more a product of the star system. So movies were sold upon who was in it. Mm-hmm. Is it going to be Myrna Loy and William Powell in a comedy? Is it going to be Clark Gable? Is it going to be
Greta Garbo?
Yeah, exactly. We don't know what Clark Gable's going to be, but we know Clark Gable's in this movie.
And look, that system is still more or less in place. I mean, granted, you don't have actors signing, you know, six picture deals with studios all that often anymore. That has kind of gone away. It still exists. It's not as rigid as
now
it used to be.
Now they form their own production companies.
That too. I mean, that started with United Artists. And it still exists. And yet, you know, you have somebody like Tom Cruise, who at one point was a completely unstoppable box office figure. If you had Tom Cruise's name above the title, you could guarantee that people were going to come and see it. And yet just this summer, he put out The Mummy, which yeah. was a flop. And
it's a terrible movie.
Well, that too, but he's been in lots of terrible movies that have been successful. You know what I rewatched recently? Cocktail. That movie's horrible. And it made a whole bunch of money because Tom Cruise was in it. Yeah. It has no redeeming value whatsoever. And so I think that that whole idea that,
yet you rewatched
this,
it.
I was curious to see.
It
had Elizabeth Shue. And another thing, too, is, you know.
So what about Harry Potter and what about Lord of the Rings and those types of things?
Plays into exactly what you were talking about, because those were based upon novels that were the runaway bestsellers of probably the 20th century.
And if anything, you know, Avatar is actually kind of the weird outlier here because it's the highest grossing film of all time. It's a movie that everybody was talking about it while it was in theaters. And I haven't heard anybody talk about Avatar in the years since it came out. I haven't seen it since it came out. It seems
everybody's been waiting for the sequel.
That critical feeling towards Avatar has definitely dimmed in the near decade since it's been in theaters.
And I still think it's the benchmark of recent films with respect to 3D, though.
Sure,
3D,
but it's the outlier in the sense that that was, even though it's culling from a lot of different things, was an original property. I mean, it's an original screenplay. I mean, it rips off a whole bunch of stuff.
But it's sure does.
But it's not based on characters that we already knew. So, and I guess Titanic was the same way. I mean, it's mm-hmm. based on a historical event, but so I guess James Cameron is the outlier.
It's unlike the Terminator series.
Exactly.
The first one, which was this down and dirty little film
that became
this amazing thing, and then it developed into this whole series. Unlike it, these others are still at this point. There's no Titanic 2.
And honestly,
in
my opinion, James Cameron's best film is one of the great blockbuster films of all time, which is Terminator 2 Judgment Day, which is just such a great crowd pleaser of a movie. It still has amazing special effects that hold up. And so you rarely see, like you were talking about earlier, you rarely see critical acclaim line up with financial success. And, you know, I can't believe that we've only mentioned him in passing, but I mean, Steven Spielberg is the king of that. I mean,
Looking
through his films post-Jaws, Close Encounters of the Third Kind, Raiders of the Lost Ark, Poltergeist, E.T., Jurassic Park, Saving Private Ryan, which I had to look this up, was the second highest grossing film of 1998 behind only Armageddon. This big 2.5-hour R-rated war film was one of the highest grossing films of that year. Even the movies he's produced, Back to the Future, Goonies, Gremlins. Mm-hmm. I mean, his star power has dimmed a little bit as well, but I mean, he was on a tear there in the 1980s.
So in the past, when you talked about blockbusters, and if you adjust some of these films for inflation in terms of their gross, we do have films such as Gone with the Wind. I mean, even something like Dr. Zhivago. We haven't talked about any animated films, whether it be Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs or Finding Dory
or any of those things,
because I do think that, again, depending on what you're looking at,
not much blew up in those things. So I don't know whether
The Incredibles, there are quite
The Incredibles.
CGI explosions in The Incredibles.
The other thing we haven't really talked about, I think we've touched upon it, is when these things come out, because almost always people talk about summer blockbusters, and yet in recent years that has not been the case. The film that is leading everything this year was Beauty and the Beast, and that came out in March.
That's already made north of $1 billion worldwide.
Rogue One, a Star Wars story, the leading film in 2016, came out in December. Star Wars, The Force Awakens, out in December as well. Yes. So summer is not the big time anymore. I think it goes back to exactly what both of you were saying in terms of what you particularly were saying, Mary Pat. There's an expectation. There's a ready-made audience for some of these films, the Star Wars movies,
Harry
Potter movies, the Expendables.
Sure.
17, you know.
Well, since we only have a couple of minutes left, I think what we have to do is go around and maybe pick our favorite quote-unquote blockbuster.
Yeah, I've been thinking about this. I cannot choose, so I have to just say Spielberg, and it's split between Jaws and Jurassic Park. My measure is, will I watch it again and again and again? I will watch both those movies again and again and again.
I have to go with it's the first, and I think it's still the best. It's Jaws, which I think is technically a perfect film. I don't think there's a single wrong thing on Jaws, not a blemish upon it.
I will name a blemish once the show's over, but I love Jaws.
Jaws is, and it's on TV all the time, and it's one of those movies. It's like Back to the Future, which I considered too. Whenever it's on, I have to stop and watch it. And it's amazing because most of that movie is three character actors on a boat.
Yes,
and yet
exactly.
it started this whole trend.
Mary Pat, you have 30 seconds.
Okay, I'm going to say the original Alien. I always loved Sigourney Weaver. I just was enthralled by it. And I think
a whole spaceship blows up in that one.
Right, exactly. Hey. Yep.
And that closes out this special edition of Movies 101, which we devoted to a study of the blockbuster. I'm Dan Webster, and I was joined, as always, by Nathan Weinbinder and Mary Pat Truthart. We need to thank Jim Tevenet for both producing and engineering the show, and thank you to our loyal listeners. And we invite you back next week, same time, same spot on the radio dial, when we'll again try to brave the world of contemporary cinema. Until then, consider these words from actor Sean Penn. Well, look at all these summer blockbusters. You can't help but laugh a little because you've already seen a lot of these movies 482 times. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio.
The Movies 101 podcast is made possible by the members of Spokane Public Radio. Become a member at SpokanePublicRadio.org. Thanks for listening to Movies 101.